Blog Talk Radio.
For your God is, for your God is come to me. For your God is, for your God is come to me. I need your wisdom for this age. For this age, warrior goddess, warrior goddess, come to me. Warrior goddess, warrior goddess, come to me.
Well, good evening and welcome, my friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. This is Karen Tate, and tonight's musical offering opening the show was Warrior Goddess by Lisa Thiel, one of my favorites, myself being a Sekhmet sister. So thank you, Lisa, for the use of your beautiful music. And as I promised, to honor Keith Olbermann, formerly of Countdown fame on MSNBC, who we hope will be back on the airwaves sometime in late July, it is 23 weeks and counting until his return to his public. And until he returns, I'll ask the question he would have been asking every night. Mr. Boehner, where are the jobs? We thought you were so concerned, or so you told the voters. But let's turn our attention to tonight's show. As many of you know, adversaries of the Sacred Feminine tried to sweep away awareness and knowledge of her for all time. And with that sweeping away, when the great she was made to disappear because of the religion of patriarchy, of sometimes from selfish and disconnected men and their war gods, women in their power, their leadership, their spiritual authority were thwarted, repressed, became taboo, diminished, and disrespected. That's why here on the show I'm dedicated to recovering the great she, whether she be deity, archetype, or ideal. Yes, we intend to defy, to taste the forbidden fruit, to be powerful and uppity women, to throw off the shackles, look under every rock, behind every locked door, peer into the abyss of the past so we know why things are the way they are, how they have become so turned on their head and so unnatural. And we're going to go about setting things right. Why? Because if we want to save ourselves as a species, I think we have no other choice. If we want to restore balance, harmony, wholeness, sanity, it is women armed with our like-minded brothers, armed with ideas of the sacred feminine, who will set things back on course. Well, this week marks the turning point in the Celtic year, the time of the sacred holiday of Imbolc, announcing the arrival of new life, and in turn it is the time of Bridget. So tonight we honor an aspect of the great she in her two best-known guises, St. Bridget the Saint, who was an abbess, and Bridget, goddess of poetry, healing, and smithwork. I like to think of her sacred waters mixing with her fire to make steam, a catalyst for forward movement and transformation. Here's what Alexander Carmichael said about Bridget. Quote, Bridget, with her white wand, is said to breathe life into the mouth of the dead winter and to bring him to open his eyes to the tears and the smiles, the sighs and the laughter of spring. Well, according to Mary Condren in her article for the Irish Times titled St. Bridget, No Better Woman for the Time We Live In, she says, quote, before mass media and travel and great political rallies, societies were held together by fragile threads and weaving tools signified a key responsibility, that of weaving the precious webs of life and tending the bonds of community. Bridget was also a peace weaver, the name given to distinguished women in old European times. Peace weavers sometimes married into their enemy's tribe, and their daughters carried gifts to weave peace. Such women had great negotiating skills and authority. Condren goes on to say, as with such peace weavers, St. Bridget caused mists to appear between opposing sides in order to prevent bloodshed. With her nuns, she accompanied protesting warriors to the battlefield, rendering them unable to fight. In historical times, the abbesses of Kildare, who succeeded the historical 5th century Bridget, could pardon criminals encountered on their way to execution. They were revered figures of authority who were known as those who turned back the streams of war. According to Condren, Bridget wove the fragile threads of life into webs of community. She invented a shriek alarm for vulnerable women traveling alone. She secured women's property rights when Senshaw, the judge, threatened to abolish them, and she freed a slave-trafficked woman. Above all, her bountiful nature ensured that the life force was kept moving for the benefit of all and was not stagnated by greed. Today, weavers and nurturers, community activists, parents, carers, and educators continue to weave webs of empowerment. Their authority is fragile rather than heroic. Their work is often unpaid. Their views are unrepresented, and their perspectives are silenced in the corridors of political or religious power. Condren concludes, "Today, the old religious and political structures have crashed all around us, and any new arrangements, weavers and nurturers must be represented, and their voices heard loud and clear. No better woman than Bridget to inspire their efforts. Well, blessed be. Let us let loose our sacred roar." Well, you're going to hear more about honoring Bridget tonight from our first guest, M. Maka Nightmare, an elder in the pagan community, who will also be discussing building pagan community. And following Maka, we have Professor of Classical Studies Carl Ruck from Boston University, author of The Road to Eleusis, Unveiling the Secret of the Mysteries. We'll be discussing the cult of Demeter and Persephone and their mysterious rituals of ancient Greece, with emphasis on the roles of priestesses and the use of entheogens or hallucinogenic drugs and all things taboo in antiquity. So stay tuned in with us into the bottom of the hour. And let me once again repeat what has become the mottos for the show. The first one by the 19th century German philosopher, author Schopenhauer. All truth passes through three stages. First, it's ridiculed. Second, it's violently opposed. And third, it's accepted for being self-evident. And the second, by Gandhi, we think, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, but then you win. And before we go on to our interview, just a couple more quick housekeeping things before we get to our guest tonight. For my What's the Buzz segment, I'd like to read you the lyrics of a Bob Dylan song. Some of you might remember it. Some of you might be hearing the lyrics for the first time. It's called Masters of War, so stay tuned in. Also, please remember, or maybe it's the first time you've heard, Blog Talk is no longer free to host like myself. The last year has been great because Blog Talk provided us this platform free of charge, but now it's going to cost us a minimum each month. So we're looking for a sponsor or several people who can maybe commit to helping us pay for the show to keep us on the air. It's not a lot of money, but I'm hoping if you like Voices of the Sacred Feminine, you will help support us. Remember, like Goddess teaches us, what you tend to, what you nurture and nourish, well, it thrives, and what you neglect, it withers. So thanks to those of you who have already sent in contributions. So here I am, I guess, again, sounding like PBS on fundraising drive. Please help support us to keep us on the air. And if you'd like to make a contribution, go to the Goddess Store page of my website at KierenTate.com, and there are PayPal buttons. You can make a donation of any amount you can afford. And please remember the three F's. While you're looking at my show page, they're right there in front of you. I'd love it if you would mark Voices of the Sacred Feminine a favorite. Also, be sure to become our friend and click the follow button so that you never miss news of guests each week. That way, you're a part of our growing family of listeners across the globe. Please remember and tell your friends that my website now takes you to the itinerary for the sacred tour. I'll be leading to Turkey, Land of the Nourishing Mothers, so this November. I'm taking both men and women on the trip. We'll be going to places like Istanbul, Ephesus, Şatıl Hayık, Side, Lagina, where we find Hecate's only standing temple known to modern man. We'll be doing activities like dream incubations, rituals at the site, Turkish baths, partaking of the mineral baths near the domain of Aphrodite outside Aphrodisias, and much more. So I guess if you're hearing the call for a sacred journey to satisfy your body, your mind, or your soul, go to the website, KarenTate.com. People are signing up already, so if you'd like to give yourself something meaningful for the coming year, the promise of a spiritual journey soon to come with the like-minded who'll be drinking in the essence of the mother and her many forms and faces. Don't hesitate to sign up for the trip because we're only taking 20 people, and there's been a good response. And while you're at KarenTate.com, I just want you to know there's free stuff there on the Goddess Store page. Check out the free downloadable meditations. I'm not going to go into that in great detail. You can take a look yourself. And don't forget, if you're listening live and want to call in and talk to my fabulous guests or myself, the number is 718-766-4662. I know most of you listen from the archives, but if you want to call in when I see you on the switchboard, I'll get to you when we have a lapse in the conversation and invite you to give your comment or question, and I'll identify you by your area code. So let's not delay any further. We have a lot to get to tonight. So first, let me say welcome to Maka Nightmare. She's here with us. Maka?
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I'm so glad you were able to be on the show. I mean, you've been an elder in the community for so long, and I'm sure the insights you're going to share with us tonight are going to be valuable. I know I enjoyed talking to you before, you know, when we were discussing the show. So let me start, Maka, by giving
before
people...
Before we start, can I just say something?
Am I pronouncing your name wrong?
No, it's Maka, okay. but I had wanted to do a little appeal to Bridget before we started.
Uh-huh.
So is that appropriate to do now?
Sure you can. I was going to read your bio and then start to get into it, but if you want to do the Bridget thing now, you're welcome to. We can do the, we can get into the chat later.
It doesn't matter to me which it is. I just was unclear because it sounded like you were going to ask me a question. In which case
Let me just do your bio, and then we'll go right to Bridget. Well, M. Maka Nightmare, P&W, is an author, teacher, ritualist. She's among the founders of Reclaiming Tradition Witchcraft, an initiate of both Reclaiming and Fairy Tradition. As a witch at large, she has circled with witches of many different traditions, as well as with people of other pagan pasts throughout the U.S., in Canada, and Brazil. In addition to her own books, Witchcraft and the Web and Pagan Pride, Maka co-wrote with Starhawk the Pagan Book of Living and Dying, voted number one advanced pagan book by reviewers of Pangaea magazine. She's also contributed to anthologies, periodicals, textbooks, and encyclopedias. She's a member of the American Academy of Religion, the Marin Interfaith Council, and the Nature Religion Scholars Network. Maka also serves as a national interfaith representative for the Covenant of the Goddess, COG, and on the advisory board of the Sacred Dying Foundation. Having spent the last 8 years developing a public ministry program at Cherry Hill Seminary, the first and only seminary serving the neo-pagan community, Maka now serves on its board of directors. She speaks on behalf of paganism to news media and academic researchers and lectures at colleges, universities, and seminaries. An all-around pagan web weaver, she teaches on the broomstick circuit. I like that. And her website, if you want to look her up after the interview, is MakaNightmare.com, M-A-C-H-A, Nightmare.com. Okay, so welcome again, Maka, and please share with us what you have about Bridget.
Thank you very much. I have a candle to Bridget burning just in, on the desk where I am speaking to you from, and it was lit by a flame that was carried from Kildare, from the nuns at Kildare, who still tend that flame. And if you go to Ireland, if you go to Kildare, they will welcome you into their shrine.
I believe they're the Soulless Breed, or is that how it's pronounced?
I think that's how it's pronounced. I had a little, just this very brief poem I wanted to read. It's called Bridget the Healer, and it's by a poet who is not widely known, but I think is excellent. Her name is Ellen Cooney, and the book is Mother of the Silkless, Invocations to Goddesses and Gods. And this is Bridget the Healer. You wear a long green dress. Your toes are peppermint, chamomile, comfrey, golden seal, valerian. Your fingers give just the color that's needed, just the jewel that's needed, just the music that's needed. Yours is the work of the yew tree for weapon and weapon salve, and one are one in you. Your power is to keep the stars bone white circling above or whirling below. Your height is to bind, your height is to set free.
That's lovely.
I have to say, I have been feeling for the last week the presence of Bridget in the world. She is, as you mentioned earlier, goddess of smithcraft, and I call her sometimes the annealer of souls. And it seems to me that she has been making her presence known in the Middle East.
Yeah.
Because it feels like that uprising is her bright light coming through. I mean, to me, she's not a goddess of that area. Sekhmet is kind of more likely, and Sekhmet is a healing goddess, but she's in, the kind of healing she does is really, really extreme, like amputation and chemo and stuff like that. And I'm hoping it doesn't get to be that way in Egypt right now, but I am totally stoked about what's going on there and worried about the people who are there and feeling very much that Bridget has something to do with it.
Well, I've been thinking about this, Maka, for a while, and I don't know whether it was WikiLeaks or what it was, but maybe it's just, I'm responding to nothing more than my own self-awareness or my awareness of, what's happening around the world on a bigger and bigger scale. But I don't know. I do think it goes beyond me. I think, like you said, her bright light. I think we are both sensing beyond ourselves. I think the world is really waking up. A transparency. People are just people are waking up, and a light is being shed on things that was just swept beneath the rug before and not talked about, and the stuff that we just sort of shoved in back of our mind. And people are going crazy on Facebook talking about politics, and I don't know. I really do think you're right. I think Goddess, whether it be Bridget or whatever aspect, I do believe she's shining her bright light. She is, she's having her way and using her influence, maybe to awaken us to, to awareness so that we can change and save ourselves.
Let us pray.
Let us pray is right.
That is the case.
Well, I don't know. Forgive the rant, but or the rambling. But I've been thinking about that a lot. I believe the world's waking up.
You said you hope that they can save us, and that's why I said let us pray. I hope we can save ourselves too. I do feel very, very much an awareness of our interdependence and our. Not being mindful of that and disrespecting that and doing things, conducting our lives as humans in ways that scoff that and will ruin it ultimately if we don't, if we don't shape up.
Well, did you want to share with listeners anything about how you are experiencing Imbolc this year?
Well, that is it.
Okay.
I'm experiencing it as this, as very much her presence expressing itself in Egypt and elsewhere. I have to say I'm very sorry for the listeners who may be in the snow-covered most of this country, because one of the phenomena associated with Bridget's reemergence is that little snowdrop flowers spring up in her footsteps, and I think they're pretty deeply buried under the snow this time. Well, I have some flowers growing outside of my house here in Marin County. It's Marin, by the way.
Well, and you know, and just really to sort of piggyback on what you said, you know, about, you know, seeing Bridget in Egypt, I didn't know until I read this article by Mary Condren, who is a feminist, about this this peace weaving. You know, I didn't know that, you know, that part of Bridget's story. And certainly that seems appropriate, you know, with what's going on over there as well, you know. So, but the other thing we were going to talk about tonight, because who better to talk to than you, is about building pagan community. And I know you're just off of a wonderful conference at Claremont in Southern California, where I think it was the 7th annual pagan conference. That was the theme there, and I was sorry I had to miss it, but I'm glad to talk to you now. So, you know, let's just start with, I guess, why do you think we need to build community? I mean, I know over the years I've been, and what do you, and define community, because I think some people may think it's one thing and other people may think it's something else.
Well, I'm not prepared to define community because I think we need to define it for ourselves, but I can tell you why I think we need it. And I'm speaking to, I assume, mostly an audience of goddess worshippers, because that's where you're coming from. And
Christians,
and I'm
goddess
talking,
advocates.
And I'm putting this in the context of all of paganism, which goddess worship is a significant part of.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to be a witch myself, but, you know, there's lots of us, and I think we have a lot more in common than not. And I do think that we will not be sustained as a movement. I look at it as a movement if we don't create some institutions. Now, there was a time when I was very poo-poo on institutions because I came out of the Christian background, and I felt that it was dysfunctional and certainly not very validating of me as a female. But I've come to a different conclusion over the years. And you were saying that your program needs some financial support, and so does Cherry Hill Seminary. And one of the things that came out of this conference this past weekend, one of the presentations had to do with whether pagans had any money or not. And they do. They have a mindset of that they don't, but they actually do. And we are not going to be anything if we don't support our various efforts at creating community, and that includes Cherry Hill Seminary, and that includes your radio program and lots of other things. We do have the money. We just don't necessarily put it in the places or realize that even that they're worthy of putting the money into.
Well, you know, here's my thought, and, you know, agree or disagree. You know, my 25 years in the pagan community, I've always found that pagans don't want to tithe, for one thing. They always want everything at the rituals to be free. It's as if the people who are, you know, putting on the rituals always have to just donate everything. They don't think about maybe you have to rent the space and, you know, maybe had to buy insurance and all that. You know, that seems to, you know, to be an attitude, at least down here in Southern California. I don't know if it's different for you up there in Northern California, but that's sort of the attitude. So how do you ever take the next step to have a building, to have an institution, you know, when maybe a lot of your folks just don't believe in putting their money to support their, you know, their spiritual beliefs, you know? Do you think it's because maybe going back to what you said, you know, you originally didn't think we needed them either, you know, coming off your Christian background. You know, I've had a lot of people say, well, we don't need anything but a grove of trees, you know. Maybe some of them have that attitude that, you know, we don't really need to have, formal foundations, so to speak.
Well, you covered a lot of ground there, and I could take it many different directions. I think that the attitude that you initially expressed about paying for stuff was a lot more common in the past than it is now, although it's definitely still around, and it is also across the country. It's not regional. And I do think it's changing, and I do think that, for instance, we are now being called upon because we are more recognized and more accepted through a lot of media education. I know that COG in particular, for 30 years or so has been very proactive in forming relationships with journalists, sociologists, police departments, and demystifying a lot of the ooga booga around,
mm-hmm.
you know, the scary stuff around
the
witchcraft
propaganda.
In particular, and particularly we had 2,000 years of bad press, you know, and so we've done a lot to change that, and particularly in interfaith, where we are really at the top tables. I mean, pagan representation in interfaith is pretty impressive. And I think we have a lot to bring to the table in terms of our awareness of our interdependence as a species with the rest of the world, the planet. I could go so many different directions with this. Let me go back to seminaries. We find ourselves, as we have become more visible, we find ourselves performing roles in our communities that are traditionally performed by people called clergy people. I happen to not like that term. I think it comes with other baggage. Number one being that you are assumed to have a more direct line to the divine, and we don't have that necessarily. But we do have to do things and respond to our communities in ways that in the mainstream are performed by clergy people, such as officiating rites of passage, funerals, first bloods, or coming of age, you know, weddings, all that sort of thing. And we don't necessarily know how to do that. We didn't learn that as, you know, when we learned to do whatever kind of worship and magic we do. There's also the difference between public religion and private religion, and I don't think they need to be exclusive. I think that can, within each person, we can have a spectrum. There are things that you do in more private, intimate settings, such as a coven or a circle, and there are things that you can do in a broader setting, in a wider setting, and I think that getting buildings and doing public rituals and stuff is evidence of that. There are people who don't necessarily want to go through the whole song and dance of being whatever kind of witch or whatever kind of training that entails, but they do want to come together. They have a shared worldview, and they do want to come together with other pagans to celebrate the turning of the wheel and to celebrate the turnings of the wheel in their own lives.
Mm-hmm.
Like their kid was, you know, their naming of their baby or their marriage or whatever.
Right.
So we aren't necessarily prepared to address that need, and that's one of the jobs, in my view, of seminaries. But we do now have a lot of we had a lot of stuff for when I was coming up. Back up when I was coming up, as it were, we were all in the broom closet, and you never even really would let your kids even know what you were into. Well, my daughter, I'm not into that, so she did know what was into, but I really had to tell her to not talk about it at school and places like that, because I thought she would be mocked, and I think that at the time she would have been. It would have been a social liability for her to say that. Now, of course, if you go to some hip college and you say your mother was a witch and reclaiming or something, then there's a lot of status attached to that nowadays, which is funny. But in those days, I told her not to say anything, and she didn't. She knew what we were. And we didn't have very many activities for children. Now we have, I know reclaiming in particular, but it's not the only one. They have a Witches in the Woods, which is a family camp for families, infants, and children up to 13 or so. And they also have another camp in the summer called Teen Earth Magic. These kids love it. At festivals, there's a huge festival culture, and that's very much a place where pagan culture established itself, particularly in other parts of the country where I think festivals served a greater purpose. And I say that because I think in California it's so diverse here, and I mean, I don't feel any discrimination, or almost none, and we're so diverse. It's just another nature religion,
right.
and we don't have to hide. So
right.
we at least I do in the Bay Area, I interact with people, you know, in a very casual way, co-religionists, and in other places in the country, that isn't so easy to do. They really have to be very discreet. And I think that the festival circuit provided a venue for them to create community. In fact, there's a really good book about it by a woman named Sarah Pike, a scholar, who has studied the festival movement. But I don't think that's as significant here in on the West Coast. And there are fewer festivals, so that kind of reinforces my theory.
Right, right.
I also think there's we're hardwired to need community, want community. And I think a lot of churches, regular churches, are not based, their membership is not necessarily based on shared belief or on, you know, that they're all that religious even. They
mm-hmm.
have a community they want to belong to. And
so
I think that's one of the reasons that we have
social?
Such...
Are you saying whether you're talking about the pagans or you're talking about the church on the corner, that it's more social than religious to a certain extent?
Well, it certainly has a social function. I don't know that it's
yeah.
more social, but it certainly has. That is a big function that isn't necessarily acknowledged.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we have that yearning, too, and that's why CUPS groups are as prevalent as they are.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm fond of saying that if we don't have our act together to buy buildings, we, I mean, when I travel, I almost always end up presenting in a UU church. And
mm-hmm.
it's like, well, the pagans are helping the UUs to pay their mortgage.
Right. Right.
And there are UUs who are pagans, but it's a little different. But we are starting to create institutions, you know, schools, and there are homeschooling parents who are pagan. But there are people who buy spaces or rent spaces. There are people who have land that they dedicate to their pagan ways.
Well, I guess, I agree with you 1,000%. But I guess in my mind, when I saw the conference, you know, and what the topic was going to be, building community, my mind went bigger. You know, my mind went to, I guess, imagining what I had as a little Catholic girl growing up, and you had a church, and you had a school, and you had spaghetti dinners on Friday nights,
right.
and you had, you know, you had something every Sunday, and, you know, they were there constantly, and I think they were a physical fixture in the neighborhood. You know, if you were in trouble, you could go there and maybe get canned foods, you know. I mean, you could maybe, get caregiving for your children. They provided a lot of services, you know, counseling, everything. And, you know, maybe I'm thinking way too far down the road, but that's really what I imagine when I think of community. You know, my sense of our pagan community is it's real loose. And disconnected, and maybe it's not. Maybe that's just down here in Southern California. But it feels more like, you know, sometimes herding cats than a community that's reliable and accountable that you can really count on. That there are going to be classes all the time, and just sort of the reliability factor. I think that comes from our lack of monetary support.
Well, monetary support and accountability and people who are willing to take on those leadership roles. And
yeah.
I think we do have them, but we don't have them to the extent that we need them.
Right.
These mega church, I learn a lot about how these things are organized from because I just pay attention to these when I'm at these interfaith meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of clergy people, they kind of let down their hair with other clergy people. And,
right.
And I kind of pick up things that work well and don't work well in those more mainstream institutions, and they all have the same, they have exactly the same problems as we have, including money, but they're more deeply entrenched, and a lot of them can barely hold on to the churches, or the churches are now in my community are serving the homeless in the cold weather because we don't have a homeless shelter, so there is a rotating shelter in the churches. When they have buildings, we don't have a building to offer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at this point, we don't. I have mixed feelings about whether I want to be involved in having a building, and I don't think a community necessarily has to have a building. There are certainly many pagan groups who have activities throughout the week for people who belong to them for different ages and different purposes, and some are more social and some are like study groups or ritual groups or making, you know, they're making stuff that I remember one, this is one of my favorite stories, one of the things that happened at, during Katrina, a Diana Coven hereabouts. They went and found a bunch on sale. They got a whole bunch of big ladies' underwear. Now, that's such a refreshing thing if you are dispossessed and homeless, is have clean underwear. And nobody ever has anything for big ladies, and you know there's a lot of big ladies who were homeless as a result of Katrina. And so they did, they bought a bunch of them, and they did all this magic, and they charged them all up, and they put little tags on them, and they said something about, you know, lovingly sent from the Daughters of the Goddess. San Francisco. They didn't say anything about witch, or but it was something relatively innocuous because many of them are very committed Christians. And I thought that was such a brilliant, brilliant thing to do
of
reaching into the secular world and letting them know that, yes, we are a part of this whole thing too. And I mean, there I do know somebody who was a who is a Dohanic witch who was and a religious advisor to the Kerry campaign. There are pagans who are in close contact and had been solicited, Patrick McCallum in particular, by the Obama administration on religious issues. So we're becoming much more visible.
Oh, I know. I mean, we're at the Parliament of World Religions, and we have a place now at, you know, Goddess Studies at the American Academy of Religion. But, you know, I don't know. I guess I don't know why I'm so stuck on the idea of a building, because I think you look more credible then, you know, and I think pagans have a credibility bar that's much higher to get donations and benefactors and volunteers than maybe the Catholic Church or the Christian Church does down the street, you know. People are going to think twice, you know, before I think maybe, you know, donating money to a pagan organization if they're not visible, you know, if they're just sort of, you know, a group of people that sort of get together, you know, 6 or 8 times a year. You know, I think it's perception, you know, that's the word I'm looking for. It's the perception.
Well, I think that's part of it, but I don't think it's all of it. I mean, for instance, Cherry Hill Seminary doesn't have a building. Cherry Hill Seminary is entirely online, and we couldn't have anything at all if we had to have a building, because who has the time and money to come and go be a pagan minister or pagan whatever, or get a master's in pagan studies or an MDiv. So if we are entirely online, which is very green, very much in alignment with our values, and is cutting edge, because Harvard's going online. I don't mean for everything, but, you know, a lot of education, higher education and not higher education, is taking place online. It, you know, you don't have to travel. You don't have to, you know,
spew
into the world. You don't have to. It's much cheaper. You can integrate it into your life. And it's, you were talking about visibility and, you know, the credibility that goes with that. We are a 501c3, and our financial information and all our tax funds and everything are available online to anybody who wants to see what we're doing with the money, which is remarkable considering how little money we get and how much we do.
And that's probably better than a lot of the PACs and, you know, political organizations.
Well, it's certainly on less money. But, you know, I mean, we have to step up and you know, beef up those programs, whether it's Cherry Hill Seminary or something else. One of the reasons we have a prominent visibility in the interfaith movement, particularly the international interfaith movement, is that there have been 2 or 3 pagans who have the financial means to travel to Cape Town and Melbourne and Barcelona for these gatherings, and they're willing to spend their money on it. And there are also some groups who send representatives from their groups, usually the big shots in their groups. That's the reason we have an interfaith involvement. Otherwise, we wouldn't. I only work pretty much locally in interfaith, but this year I am a national interfaith, as you mentioned, rep for COG, and we have some funds for interfaith. It's modest, but there is some. And I needed to go to Atlanta to the American Academy of Religion annual meeting, which is in a different city every year, but this year was in Atlanta, and it was, this is horrible. I mean, I shudder, but it was over Samhain, which is like our biggest holiday. And so we decided to go there and get a room in the hotel and offer a Samhain ritual for the pagans who were in attendance, which we did. But I was only able to do that because some of the funds from COG were allotted to me for travel to help defray some of my expenses and Michelle Mueller's.
Right.
So there is some of that happening, but again, you have to belong. This is a longstanding organization that's been doing this work for a long time and still is kind of on the edge.
Right, exactly. Well, I mean, everybody's struggling now, but, you know, I keep going back to, I mean, I really do think pagans need even more visibility than ever before because of the state of the world. I mean, I guess I just believe if we were out there talking more about goddess ideals, goddess archetypes, environmentalism, you know, if we were on the front lines showing people, you know, there's a different way to do things, and I know there are other people doing it under other guises, but it would be wonderful if pagans were out there as pagans more than what we have now, you know, showing the world a different way. Because, I don't know, I guess I just believe goddess ideals offers us what we need to make the world a better place.
Well, I agree that we could have a more visible presence, and I also think we do. One of the things that I actually organize, because I learned this from some of my friends in Paganistan, which is an affectionate name for Minneapolis-St. Paul, Twin Cities, because it's a very high pagan population there. But one of the things that they started and they had in the Pride Parade was a besom brigade. And for your listeners who don't know what a besom is, it's a broom. it's a witch's broom in particular. And they have a besom brigade, and I organized a besom brigade for the anti-war march. And we had maybe 20 or 30 people all dressed in black with black pointy hats. We had routines, and we've done this a few other places too, but we had routines. We twirled these brooms, and we made a pentacle out of them and all kinds of stuff. And we had some Buddhists that had white cranes and flags and stuff flowing behind them. And, I mean, it was very, very amazing, and people kept stopping, and they loved it. They loved it. It was all anti-war, and it was taking a negative stereotype, the Wicked Witch with her pointy black hat and her broom,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
turning it into something fun for
Sounds
a purpose.
Fantastic.
It was. For purpose.
Well,
so, I
well,
mean, I, and that's, of course, that's one teeny little example, but it was very visible, and it did get us a lot of people wanted to take our picture all the time, and we got coverage. So that helps us get our message out about anti-war, about not invading Iraq, but also
Right.
you know, we're concerned citizens just like you are, and we just happen to be witches. Enjoy us. We're not going to hex you. We're having fun here.
Well, we have probably about 20 minutes left, so I know we wanted to talk about pagan, you know, providing for our pagan elders, but before we do that, I really was interested to hear you talk about how you believe things are different from when the pagan religions arose.
Well, as I said earlier, I mean, we were all in the broom closet. You never mentioned it at all that you were a pagan.
Pagan religion times. I thought you meant going back further.
I used the term pagan rather than neo-pagan because neo-pagan implies that there was a mesopagan and paleo-pagan, which there weren't. There were pagans, but they weren't really called pagans, and they certainly weren't a movement.
Okay.
They were indigenous peoples. Now, there are some activities going on, particularly with the URI. I think it's the URI that sponsors it, but it's at the Interfaith Center at the Presidio, an event that we've had for the last 3 years called People of the Earth. And that is a gathering of pagans, like us, neo-pagans, and indigenous peoples, Native Americans, and immigrant communities like Hmong and other people who brought their religions with them to, you know, form alliances and become acquainted and appreciate how we all have to work together.
Mm-hmm.
That's unusual. There's also a lost and endangered religions project that is run by my, it's in association, I believe, with the Silk Road Project at Berkeley, but I'm not positive. Anyway, So I think that to go back to your question, which was...
How are things different from when the pagan religions arose?
We didn't even... I mean, you couldn't say you were a witch. I mean, the name that I used, which, of course, never had any public... It was never intended to be public, but it got public when I published the Pagan Book of Living and Dying. I had the opportunity of making a choice between my mundane name and this, and I figured no one of my pagan friends would know who Aline O'Brien is. But now I'm using Aline O'Brien because I don't think anybody's going to accredit a seminary that's run by somebody named Mark
the Nightmare.
But it was, I mean, I think it's a really insane name. It's a real name.
Where did that name come from, Maka?
It's a long, well, Maka is actually an Irish goddess, part of a triad that includes the Morrigan. But it's very long and complicated. The Nightmare part has to do, I spell it with a capital M, you may notice. It's the mare who rides through your dreams. Maka is also often associated with a horse or a crow or a raven, all of which are animals that I feel a great affinity for, and I'm very crow-like in my behavior. So
I thought the capital M was a typo, so I'm glad you clarified.
It's an affectation, but it's a my little affectation, and it does have a meaning. In those days, you were very, as I said, my daughter, you know, couldn't say anything. And now kids say that. They're pagan kids, and they can wear pentacles at school if they want to, if they're drawn to paganism, which mine isn't particularly, but they have the choice.
Things have changed the last few decades. I mean, Patrick McCollum was on the show, and he talked about 40 years ago, his house was almost firebombed because he dared, you know, use the word goddess in public. In the last few decades, we have made big strides. You know, I guess I'm impatient. You know, I want, you know, even bigger ones in my lifetime.
We're also reaching into mainstream churches and stuff. I mean, there are people doing goddess rosaries.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, the church in San Francisco, yeah.
Well, that's not the only place. They do them in regular church. I mean, you know, like there's a Presbyterian church, I think, in Berkeley that does that, too. I mean, goddess study groups in different churches. And I think that, you know, and certainly the churches themselves, the mainstream churches, because, in my opinion, they were losing membership because they were becoming irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
They, like, loosened up and started to become relevant. So they have different kinds of music and different kinds of activities. There's a lot of Christian rock. I'd like to see more pagan rock, although there is pagan rock. But we have incredible talent within our culture that we aren't necessarily aware of each other's talent.
Well, yeah, it's like there's, you know, I wish we I'm thinking huge, you know, I wish we had our own media so that, you know, we could really teach people about who we are and what we do.
We do.
Tell me.
Well, one example is what your show.
Well,
but there's
a whole pagan newswire
collective that is establishing branches in all kinds of communities all over the country.
Okay, but let me just pose a hypothetical to you, okay, because this is the kind of thing that worries me. You think, what if some crazy pagan, okay, did something stupid, and suddenly, you know, it's talked about on Fox News, and suddenly the pagans are the new Muslims? You know, what do we have in place to counter the negativity that could potentially spring up because of all the deep-seated propaganda, that's out there? You know, just the lack of awareness. Look what happened when the O'Donnell chick was running for Senate in Massachusetts. You know, we had to rely on, you know, a sentence here or there from...
Delaware, actually. That was ridiculous, and I just ignored it. And people that got all up in arms about it, I just thought it was silly, and it wasn't worth our effort. But I think we do have people who are waiting to step out and can speak to that stuff, and are phoned. They are contacted when things like this come up. Grove Harris writes a regular column for the HuffPost, and so does Donna Haynes. Gus DeZerga writes for BeliefNet, Starhawk, and Margo and others have written for Washington Post, and I think that Jason Pistlewaters is now writing for Washington Post. So when those things come up, we do have enough visibility that people in the media contact us. I know that I have spent a lifetime developing relations with specifically religion journalists, because they're the ones who are going to more likely speak in a measured way about us as opposed to an inflammatory way.
Right.
Well, and they ask. And we train people. One of the, again, when you get to be, when you're trained to be a witch or a druid or whatever, you don't necessarily get any training in how to work with the media.
Mm-hmm.
And we do train that, with that in Cherry
at
Hill
Seminary.
And lots of people have done workshops around the country for the last 30 years or so, including myself, on how the, you know, I mean, you don't go to a TV interview all dressed up in, you know, some stuff
right.
any more than, you know, a priest or a rabbi or a minister does.
Right.
One of the jokes around that's been going around for the last 20 years is, how do you tell the elders? The answer is, they're the ones in street clothes.
we have wonderful
garments to wear, and it's really, really fun, and it's really appropriate in ritual, but it isn't appropriate for a media interview,
mm-hmm.
unless you're talking about what you're wearing.
Right. Right.
That's what they want to ask you about.
Well,
so I think we have a lot of damage control in place for when these things arise. And they will arise, and they do arise. They have, and they probably still will.
All right. Well, that believe me, that is reassuring. Thank you for telling me
I'm
that.
Glad.
Well, we have about 10 minutes. So I have somebody on the switchboard. I want to see if they'd like to ask you a question. Caller from the 612 area code, I'm going to unmute you in case you have a question for us. Okay, here we go. Hi, are you there? Do you have a question? Okay, maybe they're just listening. That happens often. Okay. Well, our remaining time, Maka, what would you like to talk about? Do you want to talk about the importance of seminaries? You know, in my mind, I'm thinking it would be so advantageous if we had at least sort of a something beyond Wicca 101 is sort of the foundation for everyone, you know, sort of a baseline for pagan study across the country, so that I think more of us were on the same page. Or where do you want to take it in the next 10 minutes?
Oh, boy, I could take it a ton of ways. You mentioned at the American Academy of Religion, and I've been a member of that for about 10, 12 years, that there is a goddess study section. Indeed, there is and has been for a while, but there was also a pagan study section,
mm-hmm.
which was pretty much nurtured by Michael York and Wendy Griffin. Wendy Griffin is now the academic dean of Cherry Hill Seminary, I'm happy
mm-hmm.
to say.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also nature and spirituality and nature, God and the environment, new religious movements, which we are. New religious movements, by the way, are considered to be religions that have arisen in the last 250 years. So that includes like Mormons and Baha'i and stuff, and us. I was saying earlier about pagans and pagans. I use pagan today as an umbrella term for many nature-related or esoteric or occult or ceremonial or ethnic-based non-mainstream religions. In other words, non-Abrahamics, the three bigs being the Abrahamics. They're not Abrahamics, they're not Hindus, they're not Buddhists. We have a lot in common with all of them, and certainly with the Buddhists who have been cultivating us, and I mean, not the Buddhists, but the Hindus. There's a lot of similarities, and Michael York talks about it in his book Pagan Theology, about some of those similarities. But we are offering, Cherry Hill again is offering Masters in Pagan Studies. Not everybody who is a Christian wants to be a minister or wants to know everything about church history or about biblical study. And the same is true of pagans. So we need to be receptive and welcoming and embracing to people if we want to grow. And I don't even know if that's necessarily desirable, but when people say, you know, do you want to grow? Because we come out of a culture, a society that is Christian dominated, and that includes evangelism and conversion. And we tend to fall into those attitudes even when we reject them. So I don't think it's necessarily important to have more pagans, although I think that there will be more pagans because it's more satisfying spiritually to more people, or can be. But I do think that pagan values we do need more of in all religions. And that number one is the awareness and respect for nature, the awareness of our interdependence on everything in the planet, on the planet. We don't, it's not for here for us to exploit. It is here for us to use, but not for us to exploit. And we need to give back as much as we take. And we've come pretty far from that, societally speaking, culturally speaking.
Most definitely.
So, and it's alarming. But, you know, the whole local food movement, organic or otherwise locally grown, is something that, to me, is, as a pagan, it's sort of a no-brainer, but it's not a pagan tenet, necessarily, or precept, and it's not a Christian one either, but it's what it does, it is of a piece with being aware of how dependent we are and how we can't, it's not appropriate for us to make this planet any dirtier than we already are doing.
Well, did you want to say something about caring or providing for pagan elders or the growing elder community?
Yeah, sure. As I said, when I was coming up as a witch in the Bay Area in the 70s and 80s, there were very few distinctions between and among traditions, and there were very few elders. We were just all called ourselves witches. The only elders that I was aware of were Victor and Cora Anderson, who are fairy, and a woman named Grandma Julie of the Tower family, which is a fam trad. Both, all of them are gone. I've been doing ritual for a long time, but we didn't really have, a few years down the line into this, matters began to arise that called for the involvement of what I would call, for want of a better term, an elder. The criteria for eldership, elder credentials in COG is capable of perpetuating the tradition. So that's very different from one coven to another, whatever their standards are. COG doesn't make that determination, the individual group member. It's membership of covens as opposed to individuals. And they're the ones who determine a person's suitability for credentials, and COG just issues them. So it can be very rigorous or it can be pretty loosey-goosey. And they, you know, I've officiated at weddings and memorials and baby blessings and so forth. So I think that particular criterion is a valid one, but it leaves the matter of what knowledge, skills, and characteristics an elder must have up to the covens and the traditions.
Right.
And I wasn't very old even then. I never thought I had anywhere to look or anyone to consult. So when difficult community matters arose, not to mention when I had questions about my own psycho-spiritual experiences that I encountered during the development of my own personal and group practice, I gradually kind of accrued a circle of friends, series of friendships with co-religionists I liked and respected and admired, but they weren't necessarily from within my own tradition. Frequently they were.
They were. We have about three minutes, so I'm going to have to ask you to wrap it up.
Most of them were active in other pagan communities, but they had a similar set of experiences. And so I sought counsel from them. But we don't have a way to assure accountability, and we don't have any way to – there's no authority. No group has authority to, you know, keep anyone in line or whatever, or, you know, ask for redress. I guess I would say ultimately we have the desires to be a tribe, and we recognize ourselves as a tribe, but we aren't a tribe. We are tribal. But we don't have the cohesive elements that a real tribe has, including blood ties.
Right.
So, but I think we need them. We can't sustain ourselves if we don't have somebody who carries the institutional memory and tells people what's going on and or what has already transpired, or you know who you bring your gripes to. Not that I necessarily want us to have gripes to bring, but.
We're missing.
These people are dying, and we're missing a lot of what they hold and what they carry.
Yeah, and
we do. We do work with other organizations. There's other organizations that provide like old folks' homes, which I think are horrible, but we have been reduced to them in this society. We don't usually have homes big enough or have enough people in them to accommodate elderly people. which is unfortunate. There may be changes, and it would be great to think that there were. There is a group called Pearl, Pagan Elders Aid and Research Resource Group, I forget the exact league, and they help elder people that they know of, you know, go grocery shopping, clean their house, repair things, get their meds, you know, stuff like that. But it's very rudimentary at this point. But we need to develop organizations like that as well for those who are called to do that kind of work. And that will all be part of making a pagan community that is sustainable.
I agree. Well, Maka, our time has come to a close, but I want to thank you very much for sharing your many years of experience and your insights. And is your stint as over at Cherry Hill Seminary, is that almost over?
Well, it depends what I choose to do next. My actual board service term is up in March. I can either stay on, which I like, or I could do something else with Cherry Hill or not. So.
All right, well, I'm sure we will
not a very clear answer, but that's the answer. Thanks very much for allowing me to speak to your audience. Thank you.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and I just want to give your website one more time, makanightmare.com. And Maka is an author, a teacher, a ritualist on the board of directors of Cherry Hill Seminary, the first and only seminary serving the neo-pagan community, and American Academy of Religion, Interfaith Councils. She has her finger in a lot of the important stuff that pagans are doing in the world today. So thank you very much for your body of work throughout your lifetime, and glad that you're one of our elders.
Thank you, and please check out Cherry Hill Seminary.
Okay. CherryHillSeminary.org. Good plug. Good plug.
Thanks very much. And I hope I have given you a little bit of reassurance that we're not as bad off as
What can I tell you? I'm a Virgo. I like things to be very organized, and sometimes things just feel a little bit too disconnected for me.
Well, you know, it takes all. We have people who scream, and we have people who meditate, and they're all an important part of the whole movement.
There we go. Well, thank you very much, Maka.
Okay.
Good night.
Blessed be. Bye.
Blessed be. Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss goddess, the divine feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking. Some call it the feminine consciousness. Whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and ideas just might save the world. And you've been listening to M. Maka Nightmare, offering some great insights into the importance of building strong pagan communities. Well, it's that time when we're crossing the threshold into the next part of the show, and we're going to be talking to our distinguished guest, Professor Carl Ruck, and I see he's there on the line, so let me just unmute him and say hello. Hi, are you there? Okay, I don't think so. Let me try one more time. Hi, Professor Ruck, are you with us?
Hi, am I coming through?
Oh, yes, you are now. You are now. I've successfully unmuted you. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Great.
Well, before we start our chat, let me acquaint everyone listening with a snippet of the extensive life work that you have put together. Listeners, Professor Carl Ruck, he is a professor of classical studies at Boston University, and his most recent books include Mushrooms, Myth, and Mithras, the drug cult that civilized Europe, but the book we'll mostly focus on tonight, I think, or maybe they'll overlap, The Road to Eleusis, Unveiling the Secrets of the Mysteries. Professor Ruck has numerous publications, some of which can be found in the publication Entheos, Journal of Psychedelic Spirituality. They're titled Detours and the Virgin, The Entheogency Eucharist of Mithras, Persephone's Quest, Entheogens and the Origins of Religion, The Apples of Apollo, Pagan and Christian Mysteries of the Eucharist, The World of Classical Myth, Gods and Goddesses, Heroines and Heroes. He has a PhD from Harvard, an MA from the University of Michigan, and a BA from Yale University. So, as I said, it's my great pleasure to have you on the show, sir. Welcome, and thank you for staying up late for the interview.
Well, thank you.
Well, let me start at the beginning. How is it you seem to have centered so much of your life's work around psychedelic drugs?
That wasn't the beginning of the whole thing, but I was convinced that the origins of creativity were non-rational. And so I focused on the rituals of Dionysus and his role in inspiring drama. And I was quite certain from the beginning that drama was not a rationally constructed argument, but it was a kind of ecstatic program.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does. It really does.
I began preparing first to be a psychiatrist, and I had a very charismatic philosophy teacher at Yale, and he said, "You're not really interested in psychology. You know, you're interested in the soul. And psychology is dealing with sick souls, and you think by looking at the sickness of the soul, you'll be able to understand something about human nature. And if you really are interested in the soul, you should study the humanities." So I took a course in Greek language and launched my whole career.
So you're another one of our scholars who translates his own Greek. Absolutely. Well, I want to get into that a little bit later. I definitely can see what you're talking about, and especially when you say creativity is not rational. I don't know why that. I mean, that just makes perfect sense to me. And immediately what sprung to my mind was the wonderful music of the Beatles in
mm-hmm.
that time when, you know, we had such, well, you know, I guess everybody thinks the music they grew up with was the best, but
mm-hmm.
I, you know, I do, and we all know that, you know, all of our musicians then were influenced by drugs, and I don't know, I don't think anybody has done better music-wise than the Beatles or the Stones or some of the people from that period of time.
Yes, we're actually quite unaware of how the world that the youngest generation today is inheriting evolved out of the psychedelic 60s. And each generation, it doesn't even take a whole generation, you find that people with computers and so forth are thinking and behaving entirely differently. And
then,
so
you struggle
to keep up, but the programming what the younger people are doing makes them different from us.
So you're saying using the computers engages the rational mind, so that makes them different?
Well, no, I think it really allows them to see alternative realities and different dimensions.
Okay, well, that's interesting. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit? How does using the computer enable that?
Well, you know, I've really never played a video game, but I know how complicated they become, and a computer game. And I mean, I was introduced to that sort of thing with Pac-Man. That's the last game I played. So you can imagine how the complexity of the contemporary computer games makes people quite different.
And you know what? You're right. I'm sitting here thinking computer. I'm thinking searching on the internet, reading blogs, sending emails. I'm not thinking about those games. But
no.
I see where you're going with that. Okay. Well, Professor Ruck, you coined the term entheogens. What does it mean and why? Why entheogens and not just hallucinogenic drugs?
Well, hallucination means that you're wandering, you don't know who you are. The basic meaning of it is that you've lost your way. And when these substances are ritually used in correct ceremonies, you haven't lost your way, you're guided into another reality.
Okay, all right. So you've studied the use of the entheogens in Greek culture.
I worked recently with a scientist. A common term is psychotropic or psychoactive, and he objected to the whole idea of religious or mystical experience, and so he wanted to call it merely neurotropic. It changes your physical reaction. I mean, it doesn't mean he doesn't believe there's a mystical dimension, but as a scientist, you can't, or he couldn't accept that.
Huh. Well, that's interesting. So you think maybe he hadn't tried it himself?
No, I'm sure he had, but scientists have to adhere to a very rigid, rational structure. And we know that Freud was addicted to cocaine, and we suspected that he knew about mescaline and drugs of that kind, and we're quite certain that we can trace the experiences of Jung to visionary drugs.
Okay.
It would be unlikely that anyone interested in the psyche wouldn't want to take the journey.
And delve, right. Well, and you also work with Dr. Albert Hofmann, the Swiss chemist who discovered LSD. Is there a story there you'd like to share with listeners?
Well, I don't know what story there would be, except everyone knows how he discovered LSD. The experience of discovering, I mean, he had isolated the compound in 1938 and put it aside because it didn't seem to have any commercial use. And 5 years later, he felt as if the chemical on the laboratory shelf was calling out to him. And so he had his famous bicycle ride. And at first he thought he was going to die, and then he realized that what he was experiencing was exactly the mystical experience he had had when he was a teenager walking through the mountains. And so rather than being frightened by the experience, he took visionary journeys, always with the correct guidance and care and so forth, because it's a very dangerous sort of thing to do it without guidance.
So when you say guidance, I mean, did
I mean, he was a scientist, but he ended up suspecting that intuition or mystical experience was an equal path to knowledge, to scientific method.
Okay. And when you say he had to prepare for the journey, or he, I forget the word you used exactly now, I mean, did he have someone there with him, or did he just set his intention?
He always
did
it very carefully, and he often took his journeys with a friend who was a novelist. And he wrote an autobiography, LSD, My Problem Child, and he talks about some of the visions he had.
Okay. All right. Well, you studied the use of entheogens in Greek cults. I mean, Mithras, Demeter, Persephone. How were they used? And is there a way for you to hypothesize the result for the user during the rites? I mean, isn't that like one of the big mysteries? What did they really do in Eleusis?
Well, the scenario of what they did, yes, it is difficult to reconstruct it exactly, especially since the whole ceremony took a course of a week, and obviously people weren't taking a visionary drug trip for a whole week. But you can reconstruct from indications in Greek literature and from comparisons to similar ceremonies worldwide what happened. And what they, and also on the basis of what the basic mythical pattern that was their indoctrination would prepare them for. And it was essentially that they died before they died and came back again, that they took the legendary journey to the other world and came back again and realized that what was on the other side of the divide, what was the other dimension of reality, was not frightening but was a parallel of this, so that when they died, they knew what was going to happen.
Interesting. So they literally saw the afterlife. I mean, their ancestors, their dead relatives.
I mean, it is all, you know, it's all prepared for by what the expectation is. And so their indoctrination was to relive what otherwise wouldn't be merely the stories of myth. And so they would go to the other world as their mythical structures had described it and see the deities that their religion expected them to see and come back again as personal friends of those other deities.
Ah, very interesting. Well, in studying the entheogens, perhaps I would imagine you probably learned a lot about the roles of priestesses in the cults. How did they perform in these in the cults of Demeter and Persephone? I mean, were they the guides that perhaps took the participants, helped them on the journey, or?
Yes, of course. By the classical period, the patriarchy had taken control of the religions, and so men were administering the cult. But the primacy of the female was often quite obvious. At the sanctuary of Eleusis, outside the sanctuary wall, there are the remains of the house of the priestess. Most people lived in very simple houses, but a fragment of the bas-relief that was over the entrance to her house survives, and obviously she was living in something quite splendid, more like a temple than a house.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Maybe they weren't quite what they once were, but it doesn't sound like they were subordinate or at that point.
Women maintained a high degree of superiority in the sphere of religion.
Okay. I hope this doesn't sound too much like the last question, but how would you describe, the mysteries of the cult at Eleusis or Mithras? I mean, is the whole focus this death before death and meeting the deity, I mean, is that sort of the ultimate goal? Or is it also, you see people in groups, they say they take these hallucinogens for healing psychosis or something.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but what were the mysteries like? I mean, what more can you tell us about that?
The mystery experience can take you in two directions. It can take you to the netherworld and the realm of your ancestors, but it can also take you to the celestial rim of the cosmos. And the main difference between what was experienced at Eleusis, which was basically an agrarian festival in its origin, and the mysteries of Mithras, is that Mithraism took you to the rim of the cosmos. Most people would know Mithraism better if we merely said that it was the form in which Zoroastrianism was popularized in the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the solar deity, and what they experienced in Mithraism was to be liberated from the body and to rise to the fiery surround of the cosmos and see the totality of existence and accept their role in it.
Well, I guess I'm wondering how. And I don't know if you can even answer this. I just a hypothesis here. I'm wondering how, the clergy, let's call them the clergy, the priests and priestesses that are taking the people on this journey during these rites, how they're leading the people that takes them on a positive trip that prevents it from becoming a negative trip,
yeah,
if you will?
Well, there's intense indoctrination, then of course there would be the ritual that would put you into the correct mood for what was going to happen. But at Eleusis, you also had to pay for a private guide, someone who'd had the experience before, so you always did it accompanied by someone who knew what was going to happen. because it can be a terrifying experience.
I would imagine. Well, now the cave there at Eleusis, do you believe that maybe played a role? Did they go inside the cave that helped them?
Yeah.
You believe they were in the underworld?
There were too many people. There were about 3,000 people each year. But the cave was part of the topographical set for what they would experience. So they no doubt would have viewed the cave, but not as one group. And in the mystical experience, what they were indoctrinated to experience was that they would go, leave their body, astral projection, and journey through the cave into the other world, and then come back again. And come back again in the central initiation hall through the door of a building that represented actually the sexual organs of the goddess. So they came through that door as if born from the other world.
Okay. What I'm curious about is too, you know, I've seen a lot of these documentaries where the priests would use, you know, incredible theatrics for the time. I mean, they had mechanical devices, and people thought statues were talking, and things would move across the temple, and you know, people would think it was magic. I've read somewhere that they would somehow make it look as if maybe the deity appeared in the cave. Do you think there's any truth to that?
It would be very hard to orchestrate it in a manner that all those people could see. And so I don't think there was any theatrics. But when you say that there was some kind of trick, I hope you're not implying that miraculous occurrences are impossible.
Oh, no, I believe they are, but I was referring to, like, mechanical devices to sort of suggest something was happening to the crowd.
Well, I mean, that's the rational attitude towards religion, that it has to be a trick, because whatever happens in religion has to correspond to our mundane reality. And the whole depth of religion is that it opens up a different world.
So
a world that we're very, very familiar with. I mean, it's the world which is now popularized in our movies, in our video games.
Now, David Hillman, a colleague of yours and a favorite on the show, he's of the firm opinion that due to the Christian lens through which so many of us learn Greek translations, that women were not as oppressed as many feminist scholars might have us believe back then. He sort of laments these scholars missing so much in the way of the powerful women of ancient times that were well-versed in pharmacology, politics, medicine.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, do you agree there, or have we missed a lot because of the Christian translations?
Yeah, and also our reconstruction of classical Greek society is based mainly on the evidence we have from Athens. And Athens of the classical period of the 5th century may have been an anomaly. It's quite clear that women in classical Athens were in a subservient position to men, but that wasn't the case in other cities, perhaps. And even in Plato, in the Symposium, when Socrates presents his speech, he tells us it's something that he learned from a great shaman, a female shaman, Diotima. And
okay.
She was apparently a real person. And
okay.
Plato didn't make her up, but she wasn't someone from Athens. But she's, for him, was the great source of his knowledge.
Okay. Referring to Dr. Hillman, he explained to us he wasn't even allowed to put his research about drug use in the ancient world in his thesis, so it ended up going into his book, The Chemical Muse.
Yes, I know.
And And I'm thinking you're just, you know, you're telling, I think you're telling me that at Eleusis, 3,000 people would be there partaking of ethnogens. I mean, that had to be one of the top-selling thing at the market down the street. I mean, it must have really just been, I mean, maybe they were taking it as a sacrament, but it became
Many, yeah, there were many possible drugs that could alter perception. And the mere drinking of wine was always a drug experience, because the wine was flavored and doctored with various herbal additives that were intoxicants in their own right. But there was something about the Eleusinian potion that set it apart. It was a much different kind of intoxicant, because it was reserved for the ceremony, and to use it profanely, it was a prohibited substance. It was punishable by death. And yet it was so attractive that we know that some upper-class Athenians were caught celebrating the mystery in their private homes with dinner guests. So it's clearly a case of abusing the sacrament as a recreational drug.
So
they had plenty of drugs they could have used. There was something about this one that was special.
So there were different classes of drugs, so to speak, and this one was just use this during the mysteries. Do we know what the cocktail was?
It was, we're quite sure, something prepared from ergot, and hence it would be a something like LSD and the same sort of thing that in the New World, the morning glory, the liqui, produces. It was a natural form of LSD.
So really, between what you're saying and what Dr. Hillman has also said, drug use in the ancient world must have been pretty common. I mean, you could, if your wine was laced with it.
Yeah.
It was like you could go to the corner grocery and buy it, and it wasn't an illegal substance unless you were using the stuff for the sacraments.
That's right.
Okay.
I mean, there's no reason why it would be illegal.
Except
that to abuse a sacred drug would be. It would be an affront to the deity, and it would be it would destroy the mystical depths of the religion.
Now, do you think the cocktail used at Eleusis was different from what the men who were in the cult of Mithras used?
Mithras had seven stages of initiation. It was a long process, and one drug can be substituted for another when it's not available, but it couldn't be just one drug that was used throughout the whole experience. And any sacred space was always fumigated with incense, and most of the common incenses, like frankincense and so forth, are psychoactive, especially in an enclosed space. And it's quite probable that an ingredient in incense was always cannabis. So entering the sacred space would do into the feeling of the Lord, of the deity.
So they're smelling marijuana smoke as they walk in. That in itself could have gotten them high.
Yes.
You know, so, all right, so it was saturating their senses, basically.
Yeah. Now, we don't know that the hall of initiation at Eleusis had incense burners, but sacred spaces commonly did have it.
So, Dr. Ruck, why is this such a taboo subject? I mean, is it because, you know, is it, again, our Christian lens, you know, our today's mores versus, you know, the mores of antiquity? Is it simply that?
Partly it's because of the abuse that occurred in the 60s and 70s, which was coupled with a new generation coming of age, and the criticism of the way the world was being conducted by their elders. So it was seen also as a revolutionary political threat.
Ah, okay. Well, and I'm wondering too, did you encounter the kind of resistance that Dr. Hillman encountered, you know, when he couldn't even put this information in his thesis? I mean, have you run up against anything like that with publishing your books?
Not with publishing, but with discussing it with anyone. You publish it, and then it's as if it hadn't occurred. But after it's been there for a long enough time, it turns out that, well, everyone knows that now. But no, I mean, just recently, two of my books were translated into modern Greek, and at the celebration for the publication in Athens, we had the present excavator of the sanctuary of Eleusis, and it's, as far as she's concerned, a very viable interpretation of the mysteries. But my colleagues think of it, well, by now I think they think I'm probably right, but it took them all this time, and they never bothered to talk to me about it.
Interesting. Well, talking about the abuse, is there any evidence that, you know, these drugs were abused in the ancient world, or because, you know, it's a story of, you know, if it's legal,
yes,
then it's...
Another recent book by a scholar, Michael Ranella, called Pharmacon, it's essentially about Platonic philosophy, and he traces the reaction to the present day reaction to drugs, just say no to drugs, back to Plato. And you can see that Plato, in view of the fact that intoxication is dangerous, and it often led to rowdy behavior in the streets and so forth, and Plato came up with the solution that you tell people that it's bad for them, and you convince them that they have a different kind of soul. Souls are made of different metals, and they have a baser metal in their soul, and so they're not up to knowing the truth, whereas we who know will reserve it for ourselves.
Hmm.
It's sort of been the reaction through the course of history. It is a very dangerous experience. It can undermine society. And so only people who are correctly prepared and with the correct psychic structures really should be admitted to the experience. On the other hand, if you trained people, they would produce better souls.
I know you testified recently in Canada about the use of drugs as sacraments.
Yes.
In history. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it's a church that has a cannabis sacrament, and my testimony was to the effect that cannabis and other drugs have been at the heart of religion since antiquity, and correctly used, they are not destructive to the person or to society. And the members of the church that I met were very well-ordered people, even though they were smoking pot all the time.
So what, I mean, if you're able to say, what kind of case was this? Was this to defend someone who had used, drugs in a sacred ritual or something, or?
Yes, they have a cannabis ritual.
And the people were saying we used it in an atmosphere of sacredness.
Well,
it wasn't.
Well, you can't have cannabis because it's illegal. So merely to be using cannabis means you've broken the law.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that. I should have connected those dots, shouldn't I? okay. I guess, you know, I'm still interested in, you know, more about the, you know, the life of the priestesses and the psychedelic movement. I mean, David Hillman said that you're an expert in all things taboo and antiquity. I'd like to go in all those different directions if you're inclined.
Okay, I'm not sure.
You want to start with all things taboo and antiquity? That sounds provocative.
Well, obscenity is part of it, and sacred obscenity is often at the heart of religious experience.
Sacred obscenity. Now, can you define that?
Well, I think you also have interviewed Marguerite Rigoglioso, and you probably know her reconstruction of the mystery experience, which I think is not wrong because it's obscene, but merely because I don't see people like Cicero doing that sort of thing, and 3,000 people doing it in a small space, I think would be rather, you know, messy sort of thing. But she thinks that men and women sexually satisfied themselves with dildos.
In public, you mean?
In the enclosed space, if it's not quite public. But yeah, everyone was applying the dildo to the appropriate aperture.
Okay.
That's pretty obscene.
Yeah.
I don't think she's right, but not because it's obscene. I just don't think that. Well, you get to know some of the people of antiquity fairly well because they've written so much, and Cicero spoke so highly of the Eleusinian mystery. I don't think he was referring to the fact that he had an orgasm with himself.
Well, I mean, why would they have to use a dildo? Why wouldn't they just use the body next to them, you know, a willing participant?
Yes. And in fact, that was often what happened in early Christian meetings, the so-called love meetings. The church considered such activity heretical, but there were numerous versions of the heresy, and people did get together and have sex.
Yeah.
Not with their partner.
So it was. They were the first swinging couples, swinging clubs.
You might call it that, yeah.
and so now, were those pagans or were those Christians?
Well,
or
in the Christian love fest, they were Christians, yeah.
Okay, all right. Well, and you know, what I'm wondering, you know, you hear about the crazy rites of, I don't know if you pronounce it Cybele or Cybele or Cybele.
Yeah, Cybele.
Do you think, you know, these drugs were probably being used then, and that's what was behind the craziness in the street, or is that just the Christian lens demonizing the cult?
Apparently it really happened, and it was a version of it. The Romans invited the goddess to Rome and her cult, and then they realized that they didn't really quite like what was going on, so they built a wall around the sanctuary and let them do it inside as long as they didn't get out in the streets, because they got so ecstatic that the men castrated themselves.
Wow.
Romans didn't think much of that.
That was pretty potent drugs.
Yeah.
Wow, that's almost hard to even believe. Continue, elaborate on taboos in antiquity. Is there more?
Oh, well, one merely has to read the comedies of Aristophanes with a sufficiently open or dirty mind to realize.
But you see, you can read Greek. We can't.
Yes, you can't read Aristophanes in translation, because the translator often is unaware of what the text says anyway. And until recently, even if he or she knew what it said, couldn't publish it.
Ah, okay. All right. Professor Ruck, besides what we've already covered, I'm not sure if I've even asked all the right questions. This is really intriguing, and probably when I hang up with you, I'll think of a dozen other things I should have asked. What haven't I asked that seems to be the most interest to your students and readers? Have I missed anything? What, you know, any of the good stuff?
Well, I really don't know. But the book on Mithras is almost... I'm finished. It should be out this year. And it was a religion that was restricted to men. It was very misogynist because they saw, it goes back to Plato as a prejudice, they saw physical procreativity as inferior to spiritual procreativity. And so it was a bonding of warriors and bureaucrats. And the reason we say that it civilized Europe is that Europe was really quite well civilized before Rome took over. This is the whole prejudice of our scholarship, to think that the spread of the Roman Empire was a great event, bringing civilization to a place that was already quite well civilized with religions of their own, which came to be called pagan. Paganism, the religions of the country people, because they never completely converted. And as one stage in this, so and these were the emperors and the army and all the bureaucrats. And at a low stage in the initiation, as we reconstruct the ceremony, the initiate was sodomized in the presence of the others. And that's pretty obscene.
Right. Well, now, I know from Dr. Hillman that there's no word in Greek for homosexuality. It just wasn't looked at the way we look at it. So
yes, you don't have a problem unless you verbalize it as a problem.
Right, exactly. So in the religion of Mithras, or if they had this idea that, you know, it sounds like you're telling me, you know, procreation was... kind of crass and sleazy. So would you say that most of these men had relationships with men as opposed to women unless, you know, they needed kind of a thing?
Well, I think that in society in general, and certainly in earlier societies, your choice of partner was not of great concern. And so you would have... partners of the same sex and of the opposite sex for different purposes.
Well, and I'm thinking, what about the Spartans? Would they have been in the religion of Mithras?
No, because Mithraism never really took hold in Greece because they had versions of the same thing. But certainly the same kind of homoerotic bonding that produced the Roman army is something that was practiced by the Spartans.
Well,
it was not highly admired in antiquity.
What was not highly admired?
The ordered nature of the Spartan state was held up as the ideal in antiquity. Democracy, as practiced in Athens, was seen as a disaster.
Okay. Well, homoerotic, what did you call it, homoerotic authority? Was that what you said? Was that the phrase you used?
I used homoerotic, but I don't think I used authority.
Oh, okay. I was just thinking, that's not a word I think I read in my history books.
Mm-hmm.
all of the filtering.
Well, the problem with the homosexual is that it brings together a Greek root and a Latin root. And... homo in Latin means man, and so homosexual seems to mean that it's man love, and of course that's not what it means, because there are female homoerotic people as well. So I prefer to keep both roots in Greek and call it homoeroticism.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right. Now I see where you're going with that. Well, we're getting toward the end of the interview here. Is there anything, like I said before, anything you'd like to share or anything that I haven't asked that you think would contribute to the subject?
Well, part of my research and the research of the group of people that I work with has been to trace the use of entheogens in the medieval and Renaissance period in Europe by elite groups, both within and without the church. And so it's very much the Platonic situation. and tell them it's not good for them. And we fortunately are strong enough, so for us it's a good experience.
So it's only for the elite, in other words.
Yeah.
It's only for the elite. Well, now, in the United States, I mean, I know some of the indigenous tribes are able to use hallucinogens, but I would imagine, are they the only ones?
No, it's for a while it was the Native American church, and you couldn't, you had to prove ethnicity to belong to the Native American church. But recently, a cult that originated in, a Christian cult, originated in Brazil, the Native American church is basically Christian too, Christianized traditions of their ancestors, pre-Christian ancestors. But the Union of the Vegetable, the UDV church, has branches worldwide, and a branch of it, they have an ayahuasca sacrament in a branch in New Mexico, appealed the prohibition against their sacrament to the state Supreme Court, and then it went on to the U.S. Supreme Court, and it was ruled in their favor that they had a right to use the sacrament. It's complicated by the fact that they have a right to use it, but on the other hand, another branch of the government doesn't allow them to import prohibited substances. So they can use it, but they can only use it illegally.
Oh, okay. So it's sort of a conflict there.
Yeah. The same thing is true with the peyote sacrament of the Native American church. They can't import it, and it's getting very hard for them to find it in the United States because the lands have been fenced off.
Well, can they grow it, or that would be against the law?
I don't see why they can't grow it. It grows very slowly, however.
Okay. Well, you know, let me ask you this, because I'm very interested in the Egyptian pantheon. Did they use entheogens?
Egypt was known in antiquity as the medicine cabinet. They knew all the drugs, and they used them in ritual circumstances, yes.
So do you think I'm assuming in the mysteries of Osiris, if they reenacted his death and resurrection, they were probably using this?
Yes, yes. There was a psychoactive sacrament involved.
Any other of their rituals called for this?
Well, I think the whole deification of the pharaoh was part of shamanic initiation, and the pharaoh was a shaman.
Ah, interesting. Okay. Well, Professor Ruck, it has been a pleasure. I want to thank you for your time, and especially staying up so late on a weeknight. I'm sure you have to go to work tomorrow. And,
yep, I do.
Your publications, can people still get, can they still read those through the Entheos Journal of Psychedelic Spirituality, or are those obtainable?
The journal, there are no copies of it available anymore, but all my other books you can get through Amazon.
Okay, wonderful.
If you just look me up on the web, you'll find my whole bibliography, and everything is available on Amazon.
Okay. Well, sir, thank you so very much. It's been a pleasure, I appreciate your time. It's been very, very interesting. I'm sure
thank
my listeners
Karen.
Enjoyed it. Good
pleasant
night.
Pleasant talking to you.
Thank you. Good night, sir. Well, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. What a great guy. I just felt like I could really just pick his brain all night. And as I said, I'm sure I'll think of a million questions as soon as I hang up the phone and we're off the air. But, now on to a few. Oh, wait, you know what? Before we get to announcements, I promised... I have to find it here. Yeah, for my What's the Buzz segment tonight, I don't want to forget this. Someone sent me this. It's called, it's a song by Bob Dylan. And one night I will try to see if I can actually play it on the show. But I thought it was so appropriate considering what's going on all over the world. It's called his song is called Masters of War. And for those of you younger listeners who might not know, look up Bob Dylan. He was an activist in the 60s. I'm sure you'll get that from the lyrics to these words, which I couldn't speak any better than he has, you know, for What's the Buzz segment. So here goes, and I thank Larry for bringing this to my attention. Come, you masters of war, you that build the big guns, you that build the death planes, you that build all the bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind desks, I just want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes and you turn and run farther when the bullets fast fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe. But I see through your eyes. I see through your brain. Like I see through the water that runs down my drain. You fasten all the triggers for the others to fire. Then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion as the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in mud. You've thrown the worst fear that can ever be hurled, fear to bring children into the world. For threatening my baby, unborn and unnamed, you ain't worth the blood that runs in your veins. How much do I know to talk out of turn? You might say that I'm young. You might say I'm unlearned. But there's one thing I know, though I'm younger than you, that even Jesus would never forgive what you do. Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find when your death takes its toll, all the money you made will never buy back your soul. And I hope that you die and your death will come soon. I will follow your casket in the pale afternoon. And I'll watch while you're lowered down to your deathbed. And I'll stand over your grave till I'm sure that you're dead. What powerful words. Oh, as appropriate then as it is today, that's the lyrics to Bob Dylan's song, The Masters of War. Wow. Well, okay, let me go on to a couple quick announcements. My upcoming guests for the rest of February, we're going to have Carolyn Niefhammer, author of Daughters of the Earth, discussing little-known Native American women we should know about. We're also going to have Bob Walker from the Joseph Campbell Foundation. We're going to talk about the power of myth and how rational thought replaced goddess. Elisa Tremblay will discuss the Bonpo people of Tibet who revere Sharab Jama, the Great Mother. Charles Einstein, a speaker, visionary, and author of The Ascent of Humanity and Sacred Economics, is going to talk about his work and insights. Gloria Felt, author of No Excuses, 9 Ways Women Can Change How We Think About Power, she'll be on the show. James William Gibson, author of A Re-Enchanted World, The Quest for a New Kinship with Nature, A History of Wildlife Conservation, Ecology, and Environmental Issues in Animism. And then also Alan Johnson, who writes about class and privilege. He's the author of The First Thing and the Last, a novel of redemption and healing in the aftermath of domestic violence. We're going to talk about domestic violence, the crime so many dare not talk about. Also, too, for goddess advocates everywhere, I want to remind you that my tour to Turkey is going to be in November. It's being it's planned right now, and the pricing is great. It's very, very good. So take a look. You can find that at my website, KarenTate.com. And for listeners who are getting to know me a bit better, do you know that I have 2 years of archived radio shows on my website from when I was on Passionate Internet Voices Radio? Yep, they're right there and downloadable and free. I've had wonderful guests on the show through the years. And it's truly a treasure trove already there waiting for you to spend time listening, and the topics are all still relevant. So many wonderful leaders and movers and shakers working diligently for goddess ideals and to make the world a better place. So go there when you can. You can get, you can access those from my website, and you can go back a year here on Blog Talk as well. So there's a couple years of shows, and I hope you enjoy. Also, I invite you to visit the media page of my website and catch the radio interviews I've been invited to do, or go to my YouTube channel where I have some wonderful videos of the Isis Temple of Thanksgiving, Sekhmet's Mountain Sanctuary, and snippets of lectures I've given on Sacred Feminine for a Sustainable Future. And did you know that there are free downloadable meditations on my website? While you're there, you get those from the Goddess page. Just go to the Goddess Store page. Goddess Store page, and you'll see the free downloadable meditations. One takes you to an Isis temple for a ritual. Another, you get to know Sekhmet. And on the third, it's an Ostara ritual. Very interesting. I think you'll enjoy it. And while you're there on my website, please, I invite you, check out my books. My first book was Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, which has garnered prestigious endorsements. And the second, Walking an Ancient Path, well, it won a place as a finalist in the USA National Best Books Awards. The scholar David Hillman, who I spoke about earlier in the show, he remarked that the book, Walking an Ancient Path, is immensely pleasurable and enlightening journey that stands boldly against the patriarchal denigration of the divine feminine, and I'm very proud of that recommendation and description. So, let's see, we're about ready to close the show for tonight, and I invite you to close your eyes and take a deep breath with me, and bring an even deeper focus to these words of prayer. Let's begin to shift our focus and go within. Go to that place where we connect with the divine, with our mother, our sacred self. And this prayer is from Janie Resner, a woman I greatly admire, an artist, radio show host, artist. In the beginning was the light. The light shone forth in all directions, creatures great and small basking in the golden light, resting upon the earth like babies nestled against their mother's breast, were all utterly at peace. In the beginning was the light. The light shone forth in all directions, creatures great and small basking in the radiant light, were touched by all beings. The curve of a branch, the tiniest leaf, patterns against the sky, the sound of the wind through the trees, a joyous bird song, the throaty chorus of frogs, the rosy rays of evening light, the velvet silence of sacred night, the innocence of the lamb, the trusting of a child. In the beginning was the light. The light shone forth in all directions. Creatures great and small, basking in the healing light, were touched by all things, for their hearts were open. Ah, well, listeners, we are done for another Wednesday, and I want to tell you that next Wednesday I will be on vacation. So we will be absent from the air next Wednesday, but we will return the following Wednesday. So please, in the meantime, perhaps next week or until I'm back on the air, please, catch up with some of the shows that are in the archives. I'm sure you will enjoy them. Perhaps listen to some of David Hillman's interviews. He had some wonderful things to say about powerful women of antiquity. So, as I close the show, let me just say, this comes from the Goddess Temple of Orange County. Great Mother, source of all creation, and one who lives in me, confidently I set forth on the page of my life my clear and fresh intentions for this new year, written in beauty. I am grateful to know that in this clarity, all is magnetized unto me. Blessed be. Well, good night, listeners, and I'll be back with you in 2 weeks.